Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Anthem show. Back with you now. We got a great show. We're going to be talking about the giant global warming march, and global warming itself as an issue, nuclear power, and lots of stuff about saving our planet and our environment. I do have a piece posted at PRN, the website, about the march, which was so fantastic. And I've got two people that were with me on the march. David Kraft from Chicago. David, you there? Oh, maybe David's not with us yet. And Kevin Camps in Washington, you with us?
Hey, Harvey. I'm here.
Hi, Kevin. Kevin. How are you? And we have Cindy Folker. Cindy, were you on the march in New York last week?
I was not.
Oh, my
God. Unfortunately.
All right. Well, Kevin and I managed to walk together down the Central Park West and 6th Avenue for a good chunk of the march. It was a ton of fun, and we accomplished a lot, I think. The piece I have, it's at a number of websites. It's at Common Dreams, Buzzflash, at Truth Out, and EcoWatch, Now Today, among others, talks about the march, talks about the future of the climate change movement and all that. But Cindy and Kevin, you're both with Beyond Nuclear, and I do want to start, we're going to get into some nuclear issues, but I do want to start, Cindy, with you. You've done a lot of work, Cindy Folker, on global warming, and tell us about what you're doing in climate change and how it relates to what's been going on lately.
Well, so my specialty right now is radiation and health for Beyond Nuclear, but this is pertinent to the climate change issue because a lot of people who, to my mind, are not quite informed on the issue think that nuclear power is one way to address climate change. And even the EPA carbon rule that's currently out for comment mentions nuclear. But my take on this is that we've already got a 37% increase in childhood leukemia around nuclear power facilities. So it doesn't make sense to add nuclear to address climate change, because that's going to be something that we can't erase.
Where does the statistical backing come from for this assertion that there's a 37% increase in childhood leukemia among children near nuclear plants?
So this was work that was done. It's actually a compilation of 60-plus studies. And a researcher named Ian Fairley out of the UK, who's a radiobiologist, did what's called a meta-analysis, where he looked at all of these different studies around nuclear power facilities, reprocessing facilities, et cetera. And he came to the conclusion, based on the data of each of these studies, that most of these facilities had a 37% increase in childhood leukemia around them. And that's just a very specific cancer, leukemia, among a very specific and sensitive, radiosensitive subset, which is children. So it doesn't address the other potential health impacts, genetic, other kinds of cancers, and those kinds of health effects, heart problems that might also be accompanying the populations around nuclear facilities.
Okay. Well, it's pretty depressing stuff, but let's what other statistical things are you seeing about health impacts of nuclear power?
Well, the childhood leukemia is going to be the most sensitive indicator at this point. And it's important to look at it because clearly children are more radio sensitive for that particular disease, but they'd be more radio sensitive across generations as well. And yeah, it's a depressing topic, but it's one that I think we have to face because we need to understand the juncture between nuclear power, how we can't use it for climate change, and how if we try to put all of our economic prowess behind nuclear power, we're going to be taking away from real alternative energy solutions like wind and like solar. So this is the message that we've got to get out, is that it wouldn't only be an economic boondoggle to invest in nuclear for climate change. It would also be a health boondoggle for future generations.
Kevin Camps, also Beyond Nuclear, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think the importance of this moment, NIRS, which played such a big role in the nuclear-free, carbon-free contingent at the Climate March, also has a great report out called Killing the Competition, and the subtitle is The Nuclear Power Agenda to Block Climate Action, Stop Renewable Energy, and Subsidize Old Reactors. And so that fight that Cindy's getting at is underway as we speak. So you're seeing major rollbacks in renewable energy portfolio standards throughout the Midwest. We're talking Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, and it's the nuclear utilities that are behind it. We're talking Exelon out of Chicago. We're talking First Energy with 4 reactors in Ohio and Pennsylvania. We're talking Entergy, which is the second biggest utility in the country. They've got Palisades in West Michigan. So what they're doing is they are trying to kill the competition. That's renewables and efficiency. They're trying to get a hold of that money that was set aside to try to balance the subsidies that nuclear and fossils have enjoyed for a half century. They're trying to gobble that up to prop up, not necessarily propose new reactors. They're trying to do that too. But they're trying to prop up the old reactors, which were bought and paid for long ago at ratepayer and taxpayer expense. They still can't compete. They're still uncompetitive. They're uneconomic. So they're trying to keep them going for years and decades to come at the expense of renewables, at the expense of efficiency. So the fight is on, and folks need to jump in because these bad decisions are going to get locked in for another generation, just like they were in the past generation.
All right, so let's talk about climate, though, in relation to all this. And I need you to explain, because climate is, of course, the hot topic now after this march. I need you to explain what is the real interface between nuclear and climate change. What impacts does nuclear power have on the climate specifically? You can talk about the fuel cycle and maybe the conversion of inert substances to direct heat, but we keep hearing from a certain segment of the climate change movement that nuclear power can help with global warming. So what is your explanation for why it can't?
Well, I'll take a first stab and then hand it off to Cindy, who's been doing some cutting-edge work on radioactive carbon-14. But what I'll do is just refer back to the work of Arjun Makhijani and Bryce Smith at Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. I think they've still got the best book out there for why nuclear power can't solve the climate crisis, and it's called Insurmountable Risks. It was published in 2006, 8 years ago, and the major arguments were, number one, nuclear power is a non-starter as a climate solution. It costs too much, and it takes too long. That's just the facts that have been borne out again and again for the past half century. And in the last 8 years, those dynamics have shown themselves yet again. Just one example, in Finland, the flagship nuclear renaissance new reactor of the Western world, a French reactor in Finland, is more than double the original price tag now. It's many years behind schedule. There are major lawsuits between the French and the Finns on this issue. That's the flagship nuclear renaissance reactor. So talk about cost overruns, talk about schedule delays. Nuclear power can't solve the problem. And then the title, Insurmountable Risks, refers to the problems that nuclear power itself has that haven't been solved in over 50 years. And those include things like nuclear weapons proliferation, catastrophic accident potential. And that, remember, that book was written 5 years before Fukushima happened, or began anyway. It's an ongoing catastrophe. And then getting more into nuclear power's own contributions to greenhouse gas emissions, we would certainly emphasize things like uranium enrichment at places like Portsmouth and Paducah, where 1% of U.S. electricity consumption took place from the 1950s up until recent times. Coal burners, four of them, just to enrich the uranium in this country. And you've got the mining and the milling and the processing, even before the enrichment. These are all carbon emitters. So nuclear power has many problems. They have not been solved. And the last one I'll mention is radioactive waste. Just yesterday, a coalition of 17 groups at 25 different reactors across the country have challenged license extensions, like at Davis-Bessey, Ohio, have challenged new reactors, like at Fermi 3, Michigan, saying, you have no solution to the high-level radioactive waste problem. You have to stop making it. And that was another major argument that IEER pointed out 8 years ago.
We're talking with Kevin Camps here, just laid out the some of the problems, a few of the small problems of nuclear power and global warming. Cindy Folkerth, do you want to add to that from Beyond Nuclear?
Sure. So I've been researching, in light of the EPA climate rule, carbon 14, which is radioactive carbon, which is actually emitted in the form of methane and carbon dioxide from both pressurized water reactors. In the U.S., pressurized water reactors emit methane, radioactive methane, which is a vicious greenhouse gas, and they do so in batch releases. Boiling water reactors emit radioactive carbon-14 as carbon dioxide, and they do so in a more continuous stream. And the reason that I was interested in this was because there was a lot of talk about how nuclear power doesn't release carbon dioxide, doesn't release greenhouse gases, and in fact, it does all along the fuel chain, as Kevin was saying, but it also does as an effect of it producing electricity. So at all of these facilities across the world, the RBMKs, which is the Soviet design, does, the PWRs and BWRs do, the CANDU reactors in Canada are one of the highest emitters of greenhouse gases, and the reprocessing facilities, which take the used irradiated fuel and break it down, those also emit radioactive carbon-14 in the form of carbon dioxide in their case. So these are all emissions that actually have not really been measured very well in any sort of depth or breadth across the history of nuclear power. In the United States, they didn't have to account for, that's the language that they use, they did not have to account for carbon-14 emissions until 2010. And once 2010 rolled around, they didn't have to account for carbon-14 emissions unless they were a certain percentage of the radioactivity that they spew out regularly into the environment. So we still don't actually have a good accounting of how much carbon dioxide and methane these facilities spew out. And they still, to this day, don't really have to measure it. They have to account for it, and then they're allowed to estimate it.
Well, you know, this is the first real discussion I've heard of carbon emissions directly from nuclear reactors. I mean, there's this myth going around that nuclear reactors are carbon-free, and clearly what you're saying, Cindy Folkerth, from Beyond Nuclear, is not that's not the case. Dave Kraft has joined us from Chicago, Nuclear Energy Information Service. Dave, are you with us?
Yes, hello, Harvey.
So I think you heard that discussion of carbon emissions from commercial reactors. Is there anything you want to add?
Well, due to technical difficulties, I just kind of joined the call a bit late here.
Okay.
So I'll defer to my colleagues on that point. But I think Kevin and Cindy have really hit the points that we've been saying since 1988 when we did our first global warming presentation here in the Chicago area.
And you are now involved in a battle in Illinois. In Chicago, the city of Chicago is surrounded by more commercial reactors than any other city in the United States. I think you've got about a dozen. Is that correct?
Close. We have 11 operating reactors here in Illinois and three that are shut down. And if we were a nation, we would be just behind Ukraine in terms of our size. And nobody wants to be behind Ukraine these days.
Well, of course, Ukraine, is Russia about to be invading Chicago? I don't know. But let's talk about a situation that's developed in Illinois, which is quite astounding. The nuclear power industry, I guess it's Exelon, another one of those utilities that has a name that sounds like a laxative. They want to get about $500 million, I understand, from the Illinois legislature to continue to operate nuclear unprofitable nuclear power plants on the presumption that this is going to help fight global warming. Can you explain this one? I mean, this is a real mind boggler to all of us, I'm sure.
Yes. What we have here in Illinois, since Exelon is our nuclear utility and is the largest nuclear utility in the country, is the local manifestation of a national campaign that Exelon has actually been waging, we would guess, somewhere between a year and a half and 2 years at this point, which has three end goals. The first is to totally decimate energy efficiency and renewable energy programs nationwide. The second is to gain subsidies for operating nuclear reactors, which are money losers. A little aside on that one, late last year, the Chicago Tribune ran an article. A researcher here found out that for the last 5 years, all 11 of the operating reactors here in Illinois have been money losers for Exelon. And Exelon attributes that to, of course, wind power, but, you know, the much more
likely... Exelon says they're losing money because of wind power?
Yes. The market here is an unregulated market, so they have to actually compete with other utilities and other energy forms. And their claim was that wind is what was undermining their bottom line. The reality, of course, is that natural gas is you know, the real big culprit and is displacing coal plants, and that's really what's been going on here. But it was a great way to attack renewables, so they threw wind into the mix. You may have recalled that about a year or so ago, Exelon was actually thrown off the governing board of the American Wind Energy Association because they were lobbying against the production tax credit extensions in Congress at the very same time that their own windmills were taking money for that credit. So what we have here in Illinois right now, as I say, is the local piece of a national campaign. It got its formal announcement, I would say, around March or April when Exelon ran, two, three, four, I don't know the exact number of full-page ads in the New York Times heralding the announcement of an organization called Nuclear Matters. This was a collection of old retread senators and retired bureaucrats from different agencies in the federal government who are on the same page saying that we absolutely, under all circumstances, have to keep these old, unprofitable reactors operating because that's our best way of fighting the climate crisis right now. So that has worked its way into local politics in Illinois through a resolution that got passed in the legislature in May, and the final manifestation of that is this announcement last week at a Commerce Commission hearing that, Exelon might be able to get by with about $580 million in what they call funds that appreciate nuclear's value to the local economy of Illinois. So
I'm glad they have a sense of humor out there.
I don't make this stuff up. You know, I'm not that bright. And the euphemisms here are just flying fast and furiously. But what's alarming is that there are different aspects of the same campaign going on all around the country. Those of you, your listeners in New York, know that Exelon is trying to get the same kind of bailout for the Ginna reactor. And some of the other reactors that are in trouble in the East Coast as well. So, you know, we're probably the biggest piece of it because Illinois has more Exelon reactors than the other states, but by no means is it the only game in town.
Well, so this is quite astounding. They want to take $580 million and from who? From the taxpayer and the ratepayer, right?
The ratepayers.
So they want to raise electric rates in Illinois, $580 million, and use them to subsidize elderly nuclear plants. Am I on a drug or is that correct?
You said it. You got it right.
And I'll throw in a federal taxpayer subsidy. The news just broke today. Michael Marriott at NERS circulated the word that the Department of Energy, this is Obama's DOE, has put out yet another offering of federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantees. We're talking many billions of dollars, and they're offering it for the regular old giant, huge, new proposed atomic reactors, but they're also offering it for the so-called small modular reactors. So they've got this pot of money, many billions of dollars, that they want to put the taxpayers on the hook for. So there's your federal taxpayer subsidy, Harvey, that you mentioned.
How much money are they talking about?
What's that?
How much money are they talking about in terms of these loans?
I know that, let's see here, there was $10 billion left in the fund that hadn't been touched yet, even after the $8.3 billion was given to Vogtle Units 3 and 4 in Georgia. But I think that they are recycling about $4 billion of money that was supposed to go towards new uranium enrichment, but that's been such a disaster that they haven't even appropriated that out. So I'm saying about $14 billion that I know of, and it could be higher than that. They keep sucking in money that, you know, was undesignated. It was kind of a competition fund between different energy sources. So that pot of money grows, but I can say at least $14 billion available for new atomic reactors.
Staggering. And what could $14 billion do to help us get renewables, I wonder?
Well, that's the incredible thing is, you know, the Solyndra solar scandal, which, you know, was a failed solar venture with federal loan guarantees behind it. So, yeah, the federal taxpayers lost some $500 million. Well, Vogtle 3 and 4 in Georgia, $8.3 billion in federal nuclear loan guarantees. That's 15 times more federal money at stake. And the risks of default at Vogtle 3 and 4 are much higher than the risk of default at Solyndra. And Solyndra did default. We'll see what happens with Vogtle 3 and 4. They are, as mentioned earlier, they are way behind schedule, and the cost overruns are huge. So the chances of a default down there are quite high, and that's a lot of money that could be lost.
Harvey, there's one other piece that I think we should add to the discussion here, and this will bring us back to where Kevin and Cindy started off, I think, and that is that these new EPA carbon rules that have been introduced in June, when you look at some of the press accounts where Gina McCarthy came to Chicago, she's the head of the EPA, and made some statements here, and you look at some of the news accounts that have occurred since, it becomes eminently clear that the rule itself was almost crafted and custom made to attempt to bail out all of these old failed nuclear plants. They view nuclear power as one of their so-called pillars for the states to meet the carbon standards, which will be done on a state-by-state basis. They don't order the states to do anything, but you're going to have a lot of circular finger pointing back and forth between the feds and the states, especially like here in Illinois, that they made me do it, meaning that, you know, nuclear is going to be the energy source of choice amongst regulators that get a lot of brown paper bags in the dead of night, and that's what's going to become the state means of achieving the carbon standards instead of renewables and instead of efficiency. So that kind of closes the circle here on the corruption, that the EPA rule itself is being subverted. You know, got to give kudos where you can. It was great that the Obama administration finally did the end run around Congress to get some action, but unfortunately they handed it over to the nuclear criminals who are going to game that system for all they can get, and it'll be renewables and energy efficiency that will pay the price for it.
We're talking with Dave Kraft from NEIS in Chicago and Kevin Camps and Cindy Folkerth from Beyond Nuclear in Washington, D.C. I want to ask the three of you, what impact do you think that this huge march that just occurred in New York City and was, of course, simultaneous worldwide, is going to have on the nuclear power industry as opposed to the renewables? Kevin and Dave and I, when we were in the march, there's been a big debate within the global warming movement about the impact of nuclear, and some of the leaders have come out for nuclear power, but I didn't see anything pro-nuclear at all in this march. Did any of you guys?
I did hear a news account. The initial news accounts I was hearing and seeing online really kind of ignored the nuclear issue completely, except in one instance where these two commentators were going back and forth saying, well, there seemed to be contradictory messages here. There were lots of anti-nuclear flags, but then there were other people who were pro-thorium nuclear. So that's the only mention I saw overtly until Democracy Now! Really did a terrific job of bringing on guests like Bianca Jagger and a representative from Friends of the Earth who just pilloried nuclear the way they should. So it's really hard to say where this is going to lead. I know we had a strategy session the day before the march amongst 60 or 70 of the national leaders who were anti-nuclear. And the point was made that we were in the march just as much to be talking to our colleagues and getting them on board that, hey, nuclear is really a threat to achieving any kind of progress on the climate disruption issue. We had to convince our own folks as much as we had to convince the general public and others.
Kevin and Cindy, did you have any experiences at this march? I know that there on Facebook there was an account, a wonderful activist, Sheila from Boston, more or less confronted Bill McKibben about nuclear, and he sort of declined to engage and said he seemed to hint he might back reactors that were going to be made from thorium, which is pretty insane. So have you guys come across any of that stuff?
No, I mean, I was there throughout, and I guess because I was in the nuclear-free, carbon-free contingent, strategy session on Saturday, and then the actual block marching 1,000 strong on Sunday, I was surrounded by anti-nuclear activists. So, no, I didn't encounter even a single pro-thorium person that whole time. But that said, I certainly have encountered pro-thorium folks around the country. They seem to be almost cult-like, and they show up a lot. So one of the more startling examples of that was at the national gathering of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was held in Kalamazoo, Michigan in August of 2013. And a pro-thorium advocate from Flint, Michigan, shows up at the Occupy Wall Street gathering and does a workshop session about how great thorium is, comes to my anti-nuclear session to, promote thorium, and he got shut down pretty quick at that point. But incredibly enough, thorium's advocates have traction on Capitol Hill to some extent. They have the ear of people like Senator Reid, whose staffer, asked me one time, so what do you think about thorium? So it's just pretty astounding, and it's probably just, again, big money, companies looking to make a godzillion dollars on a really bad idea.
A godzillion, that's a new one I haven't heard yet. That's kind of a combination of a lot of money with Godzilla, the ape in the Japanese science fiction movie. I do want to talk more deeply about thorium after our break. We'll take a break in a minute or two, around 30, and after the hour, we'll break for 3 minutes and listen to Dana Lyons. But I wanted to clarify, I'm talking with Dave Kraft, and of the NEIS, and Kevin Camps and Cindy Folkerth from Beyond Nuclear. Dave, was there a parallel march to the global warming march in Chicago?
I don't recall or know that there was one in Chicago, but I do know that there were several in some of the outlying suburbs around Chicago.
And is there a strong? I mean, it's shocking to me to hear that the Illinois legislature, which I assume is supporting fracking and all the other global warming technologies that are at the core of King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, the major corporations. It's astounding to hear them invoke fighting global warming as part of their pro-nuclear stand. I mean, it's such a contradiction in terms among these people. Is anybody pointing that out in Illinois?
Everybody who can and scream as loud as they can, of course. Well, it was made very clear to me in some meetings we've been having recently with some of the state agencies that facts don't count, numbers don't count. Reality is, a minor inconvenience that you get around, depending on the size of the political influence that's used. And intelligence, well, I won't even go there. But it's not just Illinois. This is the political process everywhere. We've made the case over and over again on the numbers. As brilliant as James Hansen is as an atmospheric scientist running complex models on how the atmosphere works, the bozo can't do simple arithmetic. You know, how many nukes do you need? How many tons will you take out? How much will it cost? How long would it take? He's the guy who said 7 years ago, we've got 10 years left. How many of his Generation 4 reactors is he going to build in the next 3 years? I mean, this is the kind of mind-numbing situation that we are confronting. When I was in New York, I had breakfast with a dear friend who has a long pedigree.
You know, Dave, let's talk about that breakfast when we come back. We're going to take a short break, 3 minutes, and we're going to start with your breakfast, and then we're going to talk about thorium reactors, which are completely theoretical and utter nonsense, okay? So let's hear Dana Lyons sing the Solartopia song, and we'll be back, the Rocky Top version, we'll be back in just 3 minutes to continue our great conversation with these three wonderful activists. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we'll be back to you in 3 minutes.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Sweet home to me, Solartopia. That's the future for me. Green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere. Solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes get you home in under an hour.
My great buddy Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. We're on with Dave Kraft from NEIS in Chicago talking nuclear with Kevin Camps and Cindy Folkerth in Washington, D.C. From Beyond Nuclear. David, you were talking about a breakfast you had in New York talking with someone. We've been really on the theme of nuclear power and global warming in the wake of the big march. We have these three great experts. And Dave, you were meeting with someone in New York, talking to him about or her about the impacts of nuclear power and global warming. Let's hear the rest of that.
Well, yes, and it's in response to where you left off a minute ago of how do you possibly explain the fact that legislatures could be so corrupt in embracing, King Kong energy resources as means of fighting climate disruption. And as over breakfast, we were both saying, and we arrived at the same conclusion at the same time, that because the facts no longer matter, we are clearly dealing with an irrationality that won't be countered by the facts. And the only way we could explain it was through Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Five Stages of Dying. I'm not joking here, and I say that because I was a clinician in community mental health for 12 years. That we as a society, as a public or whatever, somehow just cannot deal with reality and the facts on this, and we're trying to negotiate our way out of the painfulness that we have to go through to confront the real reality of what's before us. So I think as a movement, we ought to start paying a little bit more attention to the psychological aspect of what's going on here. Maybe Cindy has something to say as a trained biologist on this. I don't know. Maybe we have a death gene that we just can't avoid here, but it certainly is coming out very strongly on this nuclear issue.
Well, actually, the one thing that I'd like to say about this is that we're not only dealing with any sort of human psychological elements, but we're also dealing with the history of nuclear power, which came out of nuclear weapons, which was quite secretive. I mean, I've been wondering for a long time why, when they banned after World War I the chemical weapons, why nuclear wasn't banned. And part of me thinks that it's because they had the Peaceful Atom campaign and said that they could use this really bad thing for something good, which of course ends up not being the case. And this is also, and that would be nuclear power. So this is what also worries me about the thorium issue, is that what it's what I would call basically a paper nuke, which means that they have a lot of different designs. They've run some in the past, but as far as I can tell, they don't have any running today. It is not a technology that they really have a handle on, but is a lot of promises being made about it. And that sounds really familiar to me and the history of what I know of nuclear power, where they made a lot of promises at the beginning, and they kept very few, if any. And we're having to now deal with the waste and the 37% childhood leukemia increases and all of the other health impacts that we could be seeing, both from the regular operations, which of course spew radionuclides out whenever they wish, sometimes continuously, sometimes in batch releases. And we have to deal with the accidents, two huge ones, of course, Chernobyl and Fukushima, and then Three Mile Island in the U.S. And so what we were promised and what we got were two very different things. And so I am very, very against using any sort of nuclear-based technology, because not only because of what we've experienced firsthand, but also because of promises that were made and not kept.
Kevin Camps, you want to add to that?
Yeah. Boy, this pie in the sky thorium thing, you know, atomic number 90 instead of uranium atomic number 92, it's remarkable how similar the two nuclear fuel chains would be if thorium does take off. And one of the biggest concerns of all, and there's been, you know, great work by the likes of Dr. Gordon Edwards in Montreal, Quebec, and Dr. Makajani here in the U.S., is the weapons proliferation risk of thorium. And in fact, during the Manhattan Project, which ended up going the uranium route and bombing Hiroshima with a uranium bomb and bombing Nagasaki with a plutonium bomb that was fabricated from uranium originally, you got thorium 232, which can turn into uranium 233, and it was considered as a pathway in the Manhattan Project, but they chose the other one. So this proposal to spread thorium technology worldwide, well, any country or even subnational group that gets a hold of a thorium 232 fuel chain facility can simply convert thorium 232 into uranium 233, which is weapons usable, and off we go, you know. And none other than Mohammed El-Baradei of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who had received the Nobel Prize for his efforts and his agency's efforts to stop the Iraq War in 2003, to stop the still impending war with Iran because of uranium enrichment. El-Baradei, an Egyptian, pointed out that the only reason that a dozen Arab countries want to have nuclear power technology is as a trump card to the bomb, because when they choose to convert their uranium enrichment facilities or their reprocessing facilities or perhaps even their thorium facilities into nuclear weapons production, then they've got what they need to do so. So when somebody like El-Baradei says that, I think the world needs to pay attention. And as Dave said about the sheer denial going on in our state legislatures, in our governor's mansions, in the U.S. Congress, in the White House, one of the biggest forms of denial is weapons proliferation that goes hand in hand with nuclear power technology. There was one press report that appeared some weeks back when ISIS seized, I think it was 80 pounds of nuclear material from a research facility in Mosul, Iraq, which last time I checked, ISIS still controls Mosul, Iraq. So when you spread this stuff around, you are risking nuclear weapons proliferation. It's just that simple.
Hey, all right, so let's, we got 20 minutes left here. We're two-thirds of the way through the show. I'm talking with Kevin Camp, Cindy Fulkerson, Dave Kraft about the downside. Let's talk about the upside. What actually is happening with renewables in Illinois, Dave? How are we proceeding with wind and solar? Are we making significant progress in converting to solartopian energy supplies?
There's good news and bad news on this front. And again, it's the reality has been staring people in the face for quite some time. Last I checked a couple of weeks ago, I think we have about 3,700, 3,800 megawatts of installed wind capacity. That's roughly the equivalent, even if you adjust for intermittency, of the two reactors at the Dresden Nuclear Power Station. So for people...
So you have two... Two atomic reactors worth of renewable capacity in Illinois.
Just
is that correct?
Just wind. Now, solar at the present time is a much smaller player here. But as many of your listeners and as you know as well, you know, with double-digit growth numbers and the fact that both the individual installers as well as industrial commercial installers. We see an opportunity for a huge growth spurt here. And I would point out that the environmental community here in Illinois is definitely going to be pushing those two as pillars for meeting the EPA's carbon standard in conjunction with greater energy efficiency. So the potential here is enormous. The actuality is quite large as well, unless you want to discount the Dresden Nuclear Power Station equivalent. So it's looking pretty good, looking pretty good. Now, if we can just get through the politics of the thing And the one barrier we've had, this is the downside, is that in our last legislative session, the Speaker of the House cut a deal with Exelon. Exelon promised not to close some of these troubled reactors during this year, an election year, by the way, if the renewable portfolio standard, which has been stuck with a problem for the last 2 years that prevents it from releasing money for new construction. That was the deal. Madigan decided not to call the bill to fix the renewable portfolio standard if Exelon would keep the reactors that threatened to close operating. Whether we're going to play this game of nuclear chicken for the next 2, 3, 4 years remains to be seen, but we definitely have to fix our renewable portfolio standard here in Illinois.
Okay, so you're saying that the photovoltaic cells are not moving that well, but that wind power is a big deal.
Yes.
In Illinois now. Tell us how big. I mean, are there big projects going on? I know here in Ohio, there's been about $2 billion worth of potential investment in wind power, and it's been stopped by the state legislature. Which is totally Republican corporate controlled, and you know, they've got two reactors here in Ohio, and they're fracking the hell out of this place. I mean, they are just really going huge full speed ahead on fracking in Ohio. Is that the case also in Illinois?
It's very similar, Harvey. First of all, let's start with the renewables piece of that. Because this renewable portfolio standard has been stuck and not fixed, the fund is still growing. It's just nobody can access it to build anything. And it was estimated that by early next year, there will be as much as $200 million available for new renewables construction if they fix the law and release the money. That's a lot of stuff you can build with that.
Where's the money coming from?
Well, the RPS was enacted, I think, in 2007, and it requires all the utilities in the state to incrementally add renewable energy to their generation portfolio so that by the year 2025, Illinois would become 25% renewable energy generated. And you know, it's a combination of wind and solar. Those are the two dominant energy forms that are benefiting from the standard that we have here. You know, as I mentioned earlier, wind has really taken off and was the larger of the partners, but we are seeing signs now of solar growing. Even Exelon, which you know, likes to trumpet how clean and green they are, has opened a brownfield solar site, which happens to be the largest one in the state of Illinois.
I know. So tell us what a brownfield solar site is.
We have land here in within the city and around the state even, which may be vacant at the present time. It may have had some sort of industrial or commercial or even residential property on it in the past. Can't be utilized for anything else like growing food or you know, building any kind of buildings that people can inhabit. So that's considered a brownfield. It's a contaminated site or a unsuitable site that needs some sort of cleanup. However, that sort of stuff doesn't bother solar panels. They still generate electricity if you build on them. So Exelon did actually do that. I believe they have a, I may have this wrong, a 30-megawatt plant that they built here in the city of Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, in an area of a brownfield. And there's talk of more of these kind of facilities being built throughout the state over time. And the other thing that's really taken off is, you know, the individual installers and installations. My understanding is that often the power that comes from homeowners and the individual installed solar does not get counted in the figures that that tally up for how much a state is actually producing. I don't know if that's the case in all states, but I've heard that is the case in some states. So it's quite possible that there's actually more solar penetration going on here than I mentioned, but that would be more in the individual sector.
And Kevin and Cindy, do you want to comment on the progress of renewables before we jump back in to talk about nuclear?
Sure. So Maryland has now a mandate that at least 20% of Maryland's electricity be generated through renewable energy sources by 2022. Some of that's going to be wind, some of that's going to be solar, and it varies by county as to how many solar panels or how much wind power they're going to try and get. They're doing this to cut costs eventually so that they see it as an investment in a solid energy future where costs can be cut. One of the things, though, that concerns me is that Exelon, I believe, is the utility that's trying to buy out a more local regional utility here called Pepco. And we know from what Dave said how badly Exelon's behaving with the renewable energy portfolio in his neck of the woods. So I think that's actually a red flag for us. So I'm happy to be on your show to hear Dave say that, because I think that we're going to have our work cut out for us on that front. But yeah, Maryland has been, and this particular mandate for the renewable energy for the state of Maryland has weathered some pretty tough storms. So we're hopeful here. Kevin, I don't know if there's any other specifics you want to add.
Well, that issue of Exelon taking over Pepco, the local utility here, is quite concerning. And Tim Judson, in his report, Bioneers Killing the Competition, mentions that Exelon is looking to another captive ratepayer base to exploit and to pilfer to help prop up its old nukes. And another interesting development with Exelon is that it has really taken over Constellation Energy in Baltimore, which includes nukes in upstate New York. So Exelon, you know, this consolidation in the nuclear power industry is just epitomized by Exelon. And its number one priority at this point now is to keep its old, derelict, uneconomic nukes afloat. But just, you know, on the good news side of things, I always love to point to Germany, where plans are going well to shut off all nuclear power permanently by 2022 and to largely phase out fossil fuel use up to something like the 85% level phase out and replace all of that electricity from nuclear and fossil fuels through wind and solar and maximized energy efficiency. And the same kind of dynamic is underway in Japan. Prime Minister Kan, who was serving as the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe began, his last acts in office were to put in place renewable promotional policies, which Prime Minister Abe is now trying to get rid of. And so there's this tremendous struggle in Japan, and it's a testament to the anti-nuclear and environmental movement of Japan that most reactors, almost all reactors, have not operated at all since March 11th of 2011 in Japan, because the federal government there and the nuclear power industry can't get permission from the local prefectural governments, the local townships that host the nuclear power plants. This tremendous grassroots victory and the electricity growing by leaps and bounds that is coming from renewables like solar and wind in Japan. Ironically enough, one of the first offshore wind power developments in Japan is happening right off the shoreline at Fukushima Daiichi. And so there are dramatic photos of these wind turbines going in with the ruined nuclear power plant in the background.
All right, so we have a little less than 10 minutes left. And I want to ask, we've gone through thorium reactors. We've talked about the significant prospects for renewables and actually what's moving ahead. I just read a piece, which I posted the link at nukefree.org, and I've seen other indications. Well, we know in Ohio, for example, that there is a concerted, well-funded, and very powerful effort on the part of somebody to stop renewable energy. Now, many of us think that renewables is basically the equivalent of mom and apple pie. I've never heard any kind of environmental critique with any credibility whatsoever of solar panels, except maybe that there may be toxics involved in some of their production. Windmills, of course, they claim kill birds and all this other stuff. But it's time we faced up now. Is it a conspiracy theory or is it an actual conspiracy to stop renewable energy? Do you have specific instances in this country, in Illinois, Dave Kraft, or elsewhere, where the corporations are actually moving ahead and trying to kill renewables?
Well, my contention from the get-go on the show here is that Exelon has been engaged in a very methodical, active plan to do just that. And they have enlisted other nuclear utilities as well. Tim Judson, again, the director at NIRS now, in his report, chronicles very clearly the efforts that the utilities, the nuclear utilities, have engaged in to undercut renewables and efficiency everywhere, and at the same time game the EPA carbon rules so that these failed nuclear plants, these money-losing nuclear plants, are around. The final piece I would add to that is, in some instances, they're talking about allowing nuclear plants, because, again, they're lower carbon emission emitters, to be able to either sell credits to coal-fired plants. So it actually subverts the EPA rule. So this is not fantasy. This is stuff that is actually happening. You can go and look at the lobbying records in the states and at the federal level, and you'll see where Exelon is putting its money down, and other nuclear utilities as well. So it's definitely not a theory anymore. It's fact.
Kevin Camps, Cindy Folkerth, do you have specifics where people or corporations are trying to stop renewable energy from going ahead?
Well, I'd encourage listeners to go to the NIRS website, which is www.nirs.org, and look at Tim Judson's new report from September 2014, Killing the Competition. It's 16 pages long, 37 footnotes, so it's well documented. The example that I'll put out there is First Energy Nuclear Operating Company, headquartered in Ohio, four reactors, two in Ohio, two in Pennsylvania, played a very active role, and Tim documents it in this report, in suspending Ohio's renewable portfolio standard. And so it is now suspended, the same with energy efficiency in Ohio. At the same time, First Energy is trying to get massive bailouts for its old coal, dirty coal plants, and also its problem-plagued Davis Bessie atomic reactor near Toledo on the Lake Erie shoreline, which has a cracked containment, a severely cracked containment. So if they have a meltdown at Davis Bessie, or perhaps even an earthquake or a tornado, that containment could be history. It could literally crumble to the ground, and there could be a catastrophic release of hazardous radioactivity. First Energy is trying to get massive bailouts from Ohio ratepayers to keep that 40-year-old atomic reactor operating for another 20 years into the future.
Well, that's reassuring. Cindy Folker, if you want to pitch something in here.
This is a case not in the U.S., but it's a case that really says what the nuclear playbook is today. It happened in England in the 1980s. The nuclear power industry, in this case it's tied into the government, so it was the British government, the nuclear part of it, killed something, a project called Salter's Duck, which was a wave machine. Now, no matter what you think of wave power, it did so to its own advantage, so the money was given instead to nuclear. They killed that project, and then they said, why don't you, in government of England, invest in wind instead? So the government of England invested in wind. This was mid-80s, and when wind started to take off in the early 2000s, the nuclear power cabal in England went back and said, we can't compete if you're going to give money to wind energy. Cut the funding for wind energy. So this is how they play the game, and it's not just this country. It's internationally.
Well, but on the other hand, Germany is moving forward. Dave, did you want to add something to that?
Well, we're coming close to the end, but I, as Cindy was talking, I was remembering the words of Vladimir Chernyshenko, the Russian scientist after the Chernobyl disaster, who referred to the nuclear mafia, which was a combination of the nuclear utilities around the world in conjunction with the International Atomic Energy Agency. He was so distraught over how the IAEA handled the Chernobyl disaster that it became very clear to him that there's a complicity between the regulators and the regulatees to ensure that nuclear operates at all costs, and usually we bear the cost.
Okay, well, it's quite shocking. I mean, here we are in the middle of this massive upheaval on the climate. We had this beautiful march in New York, and yet the people who run the show for the nuclear industry are pushing ahead not only with new nuclear, but attempting to crush renewables. We're not going to let them. We're going to get to Solartopia, especially with the great work from people like you. Dave Kraft from NEIS in Chicago, what's your website?
www.neis.org. It's a very simple one.
And Kevin Camps and Cindy Folkerth in Washington?
It's just beyondnuclear.org.
Beyondnuclear.org, and in Chicago, and I'm Harvey Wasserman. We're at solartopia.org and www.prn.fm in New York. Thank you, crew in New York, for another great show. You three wonderful guests, thank you so much for joining us. I'll send you the URL. We can send it around. This has been another hour in Solartopia that just absolutely flew by. We will see you again next week as Pete Seeger, David Burns, and Dar Williams take us to Solartopia.
Or did we evolve from what seemed? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started